Well, welcome everyone to Liberty Vineyard. My name is Zach Weaver. I'm the pastor here, and I'm glad everybody can join us. Welcome to those that are listening online as well. Why don't we open up with a word of prayer? Father, we love you, and this time is truly yours. Lord, I pray that as we sang this morning, Lord, that you would awaken our spirit, that you would awaken our soul, that you would awaken our hearts to you. But Lord, I pray for transformation in us as you begin to move, as you begin to work. Lord, all that we sing, all the words that I say, all of the prayers that we pray, they are just words until they are transformed by your Spirit. Lord, I pray that you would come and that you would move and that you would change our hearts and change our lives. But most of all, God, that you would receive glory. We thank you for your Son. We thank you for Jesus. And for the chance that we have to be here in freedom, celebrating you, worshiping you, praising you, glorifying your name. And I pray that we would make the most of that opportunity every single day of our lives. Thank you, God, for who you are and who you made us. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Well, I'm going to start by offering a little bit of an apology for what I said last week. So last week I said, and I've been doing this for a few weeks now, that I was going to finish the sermon series this week. And I said those words exactly. Yeah, I'm not going to finish the sermon this week. I really thought I was going to, and I had it completely planned to do that. And then I started putting it together, and I realized I can't finish it all in one day. I can, but if y'all want to eat lunch, I can't. So we're going to not finish the sermon series today. So I'll hold you in suspense to part two for one more week, and then we'll finish this up. Karen's video there, I didn't know that she was going to do the Voice of the Martyrs video until this morning, but it couldn't have been more perfect for where we are. The sermon series that we're in right now is in Running the Race that God has set before you. We've been studying now for about, this is our fifth week, Hebrews chapter 12, the first few verses, and 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. And we've kind of been living in that idea of the race that's set before us and what it takes to run the race as if we can win. And we're now at our final stretch. We've got two basic parts that I'll get into in a minute that we need to look at to be able to wrap this up, to be able to really pull it together. But I want to start, I want to tell you two stories before we get into that. When I was, I kind of alluded to this last week, but my whole life, I grew up from when I was a little kid. I was musically oriented. That was kind of my area. I loved music. I loved playing it, and I never really did it. Made anything of it. I took piano lessons for about a year, maybe something like that, a year and a half when I was about 6 or 7 years old, and then I didn't like it, and I gave it up, and I kept playing piano. I went to college when I was 18 for a French horn, and I was a performance major for that. My goal was to be in the symphony. When I was 19, something happened with my lips that, I won't get into the details, but it basically prevented me from being able to do that. And I had to switch my focus. I had to switch. I knew I wanted to be in music, but the only other thing I knew how to do was piano. The problem was, I'd never studied piano in any way professionally. I'd never taken lessons, like I say, for more than a year. It was all just by rote, by ear playing. That's all I'd ever done. And I found a professor that was willing to work with me. He happened to be the head of the piano department there at the university. And he was willing to work with me, but he gave me a challenge. He said, if you can learn these pieces over this summer, then I think you can probably have what it takes to be able to do it. So here was my challenge. In the next 2 years, so I was going to be a junior now, I think I was going to be a junior. I had to accomplish what everybody else had been studying for their whole life. And I had to do that in those 2 years and get to the point where I could perform a senior recital, which is about, an hour's worth of memorized music on the piano. And so that was my challenge, and it was set before me, and it had shifted my focus to that direction. I'd never really planned to do that before. I knew music, but I didn't know it in this regard. And the challenge was I had to catch up. I had a lot of work that I had to do. And so I had to enter a very strict practice regimen. And I practiced. I disciplined myself. I knew I needed training. And so I disciplined myself to get up every morning at 8 o'clock Well, I'd get up earlier, but I'd start practice at 8 a.m., and I would practice until 12, and I did that every day. I was practicing something, you know, somewhere around the range of about 30 hours a week, giving myself to practicing piano. I did that almost every single day that I could. When I went on vacation, I found a piano that I could practice on. When I went to visit my parents' house, I went to the church and found a piano that I could practice. I practiced every single day. It was a trade-off. Because when I did it like this, when I practiced, it meant I couldn't do other activities. It meant I had to say no to friends that said, hey, do you want to go do this the night before? I said no, because I have to get up the next morning, and I have to practice. It meant that there had to be trade-off of what I was going to be able to focus on, because I knew I needed to focus on this. And I had to start to build up my endurance. I shared a little of that last week with you, that one of the end results was from practicing so much, I developed some terrible pains in my arms, and it got to the point that I couldn't play anymore. Now, I went to my professor, and we worked on some ideas, and what I was sharing last week is that endurance, working from that perspective of I have to accomplish this goal, meant that I had to find better strategies. I had to find better ways of doing the things I was doing so that I could actually accomplish my goal. And so endurance forced me to have better disciplines, better training. When I was 29 years old, I decided that I wanted to go back to school to finish a degree that I'd started. I wanted to begin and really finish my graduate degree in music composition and music theory. There's only one problem. I'd never really studied music composition and theory really professionally before. But I still wanted to get my doctorate in that all the same. And so I went to school, and they said, we're not sure that you have the training you need to be able to do this degree. You're going to have to enter into a time of sort of a testing period where we see if you're ready for this or not. And so I began to devote myself to this. And I began to do the same things. I had the same challenge. I had to catch up, but I had a goal that I wasn't going to give up. This one required even more trade-offs. I quit my job. I gave up a whole lot of my students that I was teaching at the time. I went and lived part-time out in Athens so I could study at UGA and be able to be the teaching assistant that they'd asked me to be. I shifted everything in my life and devoted 4 years of my life to being able to finish that degree. It required a great deal of sacrifice. I sacrificed friendships. I sacrificed time with people. I sacrificed being able to go do anything because it was committed. 100% of my free time was committed to being able to finish this degree. When I went on vacation, I did my homework. When I did, I worked on my dissertation again and again and again. The end result was, at the end of those 4 years, I graduated. And I have that degree. I dedicated myself to these things because it was important for me to not just pass. It was important for me to do well. It wasn't important enough for me to just get the degree. I wanted to say that I had accomplished it in an outstanding way for myself. However, while these were good things, while these were beneficial things, while they're things I learned a lot from, neither of them lasted. There's a quote in a book that we've been studying in the Vineyard Institute recently. It's called In the Trenches of Corinth, and it's a study on 1 Corinthians by a guy named Quentin Howitt. And he writes in one of the chapters, how often do we see a person slaving away, disciplining themselves to the extreme, merely to get something that soon changes or soon passes away? He says maybe it's diet or exercise. Maybe it's a better house. Maybe it's money. Maybe it's he's from South Africa, so it's a smarter car. Or even a degree, he says. And in that moment, when I read that, it really struck me that I worked so hard for those two things. I worked so hard to get those degrees. I worked so hard to accomplish that with piano. Yet it didn't last. I'm not a professor at the university like I used to be anymore. I gave that up. I don't practice piano 4 hours a day anymore because it's not my focus. I still teach piano lessons, but I don't have near the rigor, near the devotion, near the amount of focus that I gave to those things that I had at the time. If I was willing to develop so much discipline, self-control, work ethic, time, energy, money, all of these trade-offs to these things that wouldn't last, How much more, says Paul in 1 Corinthians 9, should we commit ourselves to the eternal things? And so last week, I ended where I want to start, which is in 1 Timothy. Now, this isn't one of the scriptures I said we were focused on, but it kind of helps pull it together, in my opinion. It was in 1 Timothy chapter 4, and so Paul writing to his young protege, Timothy, in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7. He says, "Do not waste your time arguing over godless ideas or old wives' tales." And I want you to just mentally circle, "Do not waste your time arguing over blank." Or waste your time doing blank. Instead, he says, spend your time and energy in training yourself for spiritual fitness. He says physical exercise has some value, but spiritual exercise is much more important, and here's why. Because it promises a reward in both this life and in the next. And if you skip on ahead to verse 15, he says, so throw yourself into your tasks so that everyone will see your progress. Keep a close watch on yourself and your teaching, and stay true to what's right. And God will save you, and he'll save those who hear you. That idea of throwing yourself into your tasks so that other people can see your progress. I don't want you to think about that as we want to do stuff so that other people can see how good we are or how much we're improving or any of those things. That's not the way you're supposed to look at it. What we're supposed to see is to throw ourselves into our tasks so that we can see our measurable progress, so that there is measurable progress, and we can see it and we can count it. And to everyone else, they'll notice, wow, they're really growing. See, it's not a perspective from I'm looking and hoping everybody else sees me and I work toward that goal. It's that I work toward a goal that I can see me, and I'm working toward the goal that God can see, that I'm beginning to be transformed, and little by little, day by day, throughout my entire life, moving, and the people that are watching, as he says in Hebrews, we're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses, so that the people that see us say, I don't know what it is, but there's something about them. Something's changing. I see them moving. I see them developing. When I was working toward that piano degree, I saw noticeable improvement daily, and people would see it, and they would comment on it. When I was working towards my degree in composition, it was very easy to see the progress as you move toward the goal, and so it is simple to see also spiritual progress in our walk with Christ. There are measurable things we can see in how we walk out our days that we should be able to point to. And say, I was here, but now I'm here. I was doing this, but now I'm not doing this. And I don't have this in my notes, but I'll tell you that a lot of times this stuff becomes so ethereal that we miss it. A lot of times we get so used to living in the new way that we forget what the old way of life was. Make a habit. And like I say, this is off a little topic, but make a habit of journaling. Of making a little note when you have something that you want God to help you through, when you have a prayer, when you have a desire, a need, a hope, whatever it is, write it down and put a date. And then you can come back to it later. And you can look at the moment that God answered that prayer, that God changed you, that God moved in your life, and you can say, a year ago, look what I wrote. And now's here where I am. And you can see the progress throughout your life. That's what God's wanting to do in us. That's what God's goal is for us in our lives and in our hearts on a day-to-day basis, minute by minute, in everything we do. Not just in the moments where we're super spiritual and super focused, but all the time. Every single act that we do all throughout our lives. But if we're going to do it, we're going to need training. And so I want to pull us back to that scripture in 1 Corinthians. Is three verse or four verses that contain a really good roadmap for where we want to go and how we want to get there. In chapter 9, verse 24, Paul writes that we need to remember that in a race, everyone runs, but only one person gets the prize. You must also run in such a way that you will win. All athletes practice strict self-control, mentally underlined, strict self-control. That's our first thing. They do it to win the prize that will fade away, but we do it for an eternal prize. So I run straight for the goal with purpose in every step. Not like a boxer who misses his punches. I discipline my body like an athlete, mentally underline, discipline my body. Training it to do what it should. Otherwise, after preaching to others, I myself might be disqualified. There's two broad areas that Paul says are needed to be able to get into that kind of training that we need, the spiritual training. One of them is self-control, and the other one is discipline. Okay? Self-control and discipline. And I want to show you, there's a passage in Colossians. I like it really out of the NIV the best. It's a nice translations for this. It's Colossians 3, verse 9. He says, since you have taken off your old self with its practices, and you have put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge and the image of its creator. Putting off the old self, and he goes in, you can read those if you'd like, but he basically starts off with setting your mind on things above, setting your hearts on things above. And he says, put off the old self, and now put on the new self. Self-control is the taking off of the old self. Self-control is the removal of the things in our life that might stand in the way. Discipline is the putting back on. Discipline is the putting back in practice the things that move us closer and closer to our goal. Self-control is the taking off. Discipline is the putting back on again. And in both of these, we enter into training. Now, what's the point of training? What's the purpose of it? The broader overall purpose, the reason that I suggest you do your journaling, the reason that we want to notice that transformation is because the point of training is to be transformed into the likeness of Christ. To learn to be honorable and consistent in all our areas of life. That's what that last verse, that's where I was last week with it. So that when we walk out from in our super spiritual place, or from church on Sunday, or from our Bible study, or from our quiet time, we don't walk out of being so focused on God and everything, and we walk out into the world, and then we act like the world, and we do all the regular things that we might other do. And he says, I don't want to walk out and after preaching then be disqualified because my walk and my talk didn't line up. The point of the training is to be transformed into Christ's likeness. And to that end, we must never stop challenging ourselves. We must never stop growing. Never stop developing. We have to be really aware of the erosion of complacency. And I want to explain that just for a second. There are always going to be those really obvious things in our life that we can point to and say, I've got to stop doing this. I've got to cut this. This has got to stop because if I do keep doing this, I'm never going to be able to grow. But there are many more subtle things, more undermining things that get in there that we don't even realize. And one of the most difficult, I'll talk about some others later, and one of the most difficult is the erosion of complacency. And here's what I mean. We get into a place where things are going well. Things are moving nice enough, and we begin to get comfortable, and we say, this is just where I need to be. This is good. I'm in a good place with this. But then slowly we begin to live there. And we begin to live there so much that we start to let the things that get us there kind of slide. Maybe we don't feel it as necessary to be as devoted to the Word every day. Or maybe our prayer time isn't quite as diligent as it was at once. Maybe we're not as involved in church, or we're not reaching out and having community with fellow believers. Maybe we're, whatever it is that got us to that place, we can get complacent to the place that it begins to undermine and erode the progress. And without meaning to, this kind of anti-attack of the enemy subtly begins to erode the foundation. And then we get to that place where we step back and look and say, why am I struggling so much? Why am I finding myself kind of just hurting, or I'm really finding myself exhausted, or I'm finding that ministry that God's really called me to, or the callings of life, they just don't have the same kind of allure, the same desire in my heart anymore. It's that erosion of complacency. The third thing of training, the point of training, is not to wait until we're into a difficult situation to decide that we're going to try to develop self-control and discipline and just say, hey, I'm already in the middle of this struggle. Let me add one more thing. No, that's a terrible idea. Because when we get, I'm not saying it's a bad idea to get into it whenever you get into it, but to think in the middle of that struggle you're going to add that discipline and it's going to seem easy and a release, God can still work miracles and he's still going to do amazing things. And if we're still and know that he's God and we let him be in control of our lives, yes, even in the middle of that disaster that's going on in our lives and our hearts, we can still feel that peace. But to think that developing this kind of discipline and control is going to be easy in that moment, it's not. Those moments in my life when I planned and struggled for that piano degree and for the composition degree, those are some of the most intense moments in my life. And I in some ways, literally, like, killed parts of myself to make those things happen. I lost parts of myself trying to make this happen. Things, and it was so much. I enjoyed it. But how much better would it have been? I really don't have regret for it, but how much better would it have been if I'd have spent my whole life preparing for the piano and I could have gotten into that and thought, this is just that next movement. And yes, it's harder, but I already kind of have a foundation in place. I get into that and said, wow, this is harder and I have nothing. I've got to start from square one. Much harder. The idea is to have it already in place so that it becomes stability and it becomes comfort. So you can say with pretty well certainty, everything else may fade away. Everything else may crumble around me, but I know what it feels like to go to my Bible in the morning. I know what it feels like to go to my Jesus and pray. I know what it feels like to go and call my friend that I've got in place that I'm accountable to and say, this is what's going on. That already we have these systems, these disciplines, these things in our lives so that when the struggle comes, we know where we can count on and what we can focus on. So what are the elements of good training? We're going to enter into that part, but what are those elements? I said there were two broad areas. One was self-control, and the other's discipline, but within those, there's a breakdown that I want to go through, and we're going to look at two of those today, and then we're going to, I could do my Scouts Honor thing still. I promise next week, we're going to finish it. I promise. I can do it. I've got it. It's ready. I just don't have time to say it all today. We're going to look at two parts today. The first element of good training, and this is so important, we cannot overlook it. You absolutely, in any kind of training, it doesn't matter what it is you're doing, you must have proper fuel. You must have proper fuel. What are you putting into your body for training? I've used this show as a reference so many times, I probably ought to have some sort of, like, ought to be paying rights to it or something. But I love, there's a show that used to be on TV. It probably still is. I just don't see it anymore. It's called The Biggest Loser. Has anybody ever seen this show? The Biggest Loser is a competition where people go to be trained to lose massive amounts of weight in a very short period of time through extremely strenuous exercise. And they're very much like me, deciding to jump into the piano degree in the last 2 years of my college tenure there. They just are thrown out of a lifestyle where they didn't think about any like exercise or they had, but it hadn't worked, and they didn't consider their diet and they didn't consider their habits in their life. And all of a sudden they're just forced into this hyper-controlled environment. And one of the first things that they do, besides the exercise and the training, is they control their diet. That's what the first thing that they do is they monitor every single calorie that they intake. Every single gram of fat. Is it a good fat? Is it a bad fat? And it's all individually worked out and mapped out for each individual person's body type, for their goals, for everything else. But they monitor every single element of it. And the thing I love is that toward the end, they give them this opportunity. They go back home and they live their regular life for a little while. And then they come back into the show again. They come back to say what they've learned and what's happened and how they've been able to live it. And one of the things that they almost always say is I went back, and they'll show video footage of them going to like a hamburger joint or going to like a Mexican food place. And there's nothing wrong with this food, but if you've been eating, you know, kale and beans and I don't know what else for 6 months, and you go eat like a burger and fries and a milkshake, oh my goodness. And they just say, I couldn't believe that I used to put this into my body. Now, is the stuff bad? No. But at the level they might be eating it or you might be consuming it, it is. And the point is that when you begin to restrict certain things in your life, you now are hyper, and we're going to talk about that more in a second, hypersensitive to those elements when they return. If you don't eat sugar for a month, and you decide to go grab a Snickers, you're going to notice you had some sugar. You're going to feel it. Anybody ever given up caffeine for a while? Oh, gosh, I remember when I did that. I did that for 40 days and decided that I would... That first cup of coffee, I was just shaking and vibrating, and I thought, this is one cup of coffee. I used to drink 6 cups of coffee a day. This is just one little thing. What you put into your body really matters. It really matters. It matters so much that it almost won't matter whatever else you do if what you're feeding your body isn't matching up with those things, because your body is now going to process those things and turn them into fuel. And the food that we eat is going to be used for the training we do for physical training. And the spiritual food that we put into our bodies is going to be used as the fuel for spiritual training, and for developing disciplines, and for developing self-control. So examine yourself. What are you feeding your mind? What do your ears hear? I know we've sang that song to our kids, be careful little ears what you hear, be careful little eyes what you see. What are your eyes seeing? What goes into your mind? What goes into your heart on a regular basis? In that same study, that Corinthian study, I wanted to read you this because it so struck me how this subtle thing sometimes can get into our lives without meaning to. He writes in one of the questions, again, Quentin Howlett, he writes, what are you reading? Are there books, magazines, or files on your bookshelves or on your hard drives that you'd prefer others not know of? The same applies to what you read or look at on the internet. What movies do you watch on TV? Consider this. How much adultery did you watch last week? How many murders? How many did you watch with your children? And we start to consider, I mean, we can go on and on. What kind of music are we listening to? What are we hearing? What kind of words do we allow to slowly creep into our internal vocabulary? We might not say them out loud, but we hear them. And the problem is, over time, we become desensitized to these things. We start to not recognize if we hear like a curse word, or if we see something that's kind of profane, or if I know that Amy and I, my wife and I, there was a show that we used to love to watch when we were younger. We used to like to watch this show. If you watch the show, I have to be careful how I phrase all of this. But we used to watch this show that I would have said was one of the most innocent and wonderful shows. I loved it. It was very wholesome. It's called Friends. Anybody ever seen Friends? Very wholesome, I said. We started to try to watch that the other day. Or I don't know, it's been a year and a half ago or something. And we went back, they put it on Netflix, and so we said, well, let's watch that. It was like adultery, it was sort of like sleeping around, lots of sexual stuff. And I thought, I was putting that into my body, and I didn't even know it. I didn't even realize it. We begin desensitizing process to this gradual decline over time until we suddenly don't realize it anymore. We don't realize what's coming in. But as we begin to restrict, as we begin to limit those things, as we begin to take really serious account of what we're feeding our mind, what we're feeding into our ears and in through our eyes, what we're exposing ourselves to, be it innocent on the surface or not, noticing that kind of stuff and beginning to clear it out, to cleanse it out, we begin to be sensitive again. We begin to really be aware of the things that we hear in life. We begin to notice them. And that hyper-awareness is extremely important to be able to feed your body the right and proper fuel. Because so many things, we would say, yeah, it's very innocent. This is fine. And upon further examination, realize, I didn't think about that being in there. I didn't think about how that changes my thought patterns or changes my mind or what gets into me. And it's all fuel. See, this is self-control. Self-control is practicing abstinence, but not in the traditional sense of just that word, but abstaining from those things in our lives that are not good fuel, and instead choosing to put other things in. We want to abstain from the things, excuse me, that get in the way or that hinder our performance. Maybe it's a particular habit that we have. Maybe it's the schedule that we try to keep. I know that for me, one of mine was staying up late watching TV, because I work fairly late teaching lessons. I usually don't eat dinner until about 10:30, and you eat dinner at 10:30. I don't feel like going to bed at 11 o'clock. But I had said that one of my priorities in my life was I wanted to be able to get up before the kids, have my quiet time, and have it completely unrestricted. In other words, I didn't want to say, I have 30 minutes, God, you got to do something in 30 minutes, because then they're going to be up and I can't have it anymore. I wanted to have this open-ended, free quiet time. That was my goal. I said, this is it. And I want to spend time with my kids before breakfast. Okay, this is my goal. My lifestyle was not at all conducive to making that happen, because I would stay up late. Now, is there anything wrong with watching TV at night? No. Was I watching bad shows? No. But it was making it a struggle to live the way that I said I wanted to live. What I was trying to do and what I was actually doing were fighting against each other. So maybe it's that. Maybe it could be drinking. It could be the crowd that you're hanging out with. It might be the books that you're reading. It might be websites that you're viewing, whatever it is. Of course, we want to remove all of the obvious, overt sins, all the things in our lifestyle and patterns like that. We want to get rid of those things.
But what about the subtle things? What about the things that are not necessarily bad, but they're not really good either? They're not really bad or a problem, kind of like my watching TV late at night. There's technically really nothing wrong with them, but they don't help me achieve my goal. They don't push me toward my goal. They're kind of getting in the way of it. Remember what the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews 12:1. He says, not only get rid of the sin that so easily entangles, but also the things that weigh us down. You know, so often we get weighed down with things that we don't even realize are weights. We're carrying around barriers or ankle weights and things that we don't even recognize in our lives. And these things are really difficult to see, because they're lifestyles. There's really nothing wrong with them, but it takes very careful examination of your life to look at these things. It takes that kind of David examination in Psalm 139 when he cries out to God, "Search me, O Lord, and know me. See if there's any way in me." It takes that kind of constant looking and examining in our lives, because while there might not be anything wrong with these things, they might be damaging and they might be detracting us from our true goal, from our true focus. They might be pulling us away. As I said with the TV things, what I said was my priority, and what was actually doing in my life were at odds with one another. And so in that instance, it does become a problem. This will be different for every person, but it takes examination for each individual. There is no one clear fix for everything. There is no one perfect answer. There's no one exact science of this is the thing to remove. It's individual. And God, through the Holy Spirit, will reveal it to you if you take time to sit down and pray and examine your life and truly cry out to God and say, "Search me, O Lord, and know me." So examine your life. Where is your time spent? Does it reflect your declared focus or your goal? Think about it like this. If someone were to observe your life, just a casual observer to your life for about a week, what would they say is most important to you? What would they say looking at the time you spend, where you develop your energy, what gives you the most excitement, and where you're the most focused? What would people say then is the most important to you? The question really becomes, does your reality reflect your desire? I used this a few weeks ago, the story of the hymn, the story behind the hymn, Turn Your Eyes Upon Jesus. The hymn itself is written by a woman named Helen Lamell. But the inspiration for her story was another woman named Lilias Trotter. Lilias Trotter was a brilliant artist, and she had a real opportunity for that. Her talent opened her doors up for her to wealth and to great influence. But she had a second love as well, one that stood a little bit at odds with her first love, and it was missions. And Helen Lamell writes that after struggling in prayer for years, Trotter came to the conclusion that she must lay down her love of the art in order to fix her eyes solely on Jesus and his calling to the mission field. And following that, she served for more than 38 years as a missionary in Algeria. And she wrote several books during that time as a way to encourage other believers and other missionaries as well. And one of those was a tract titled, Which Passion Will Prevail? The following is an excerpt from that tract. Lilias Trotter writes, "Never has it been so easy to live in half a dozen harmless worlds all at once." Now, this is written in the 1920s, and I want you to think about how applicable this list is today. Never has it been so easy to live in half a dozen harmless worlds all at once. Art, music, social sciences, games, motoring, the following of some profession, and the list goes on. And between them, we run the risk of drifting about, the good hiding the best. So I want to pull that together a little bit. She says, and between them, between what? Between the dozen harmless worlds. I want you to think for a second in your own life. What are your harmless worlds? What are the areas in your life that really aren't damaging, aren't bad, but maybe standing in the way? She says we run the risk of drifting about between these harmless worlds, between good things that actually hide the best thing, God's true plan, God's true focus for your life. In his book, Essentialism, Greg McKeown states that trade-offs are a part of life. But he writes not to focus on what you need to give up. He says focusing on what you need to give up is very much like trying to not think of a pink elephant. We've all heard that analogy before. Don't think of the pink elephant, and then that's all you can think about. It occupies all your mind. So what he writes is not to focus on the things you need to give up. Yes, you need to give them up, but that's not the focus. He says instead, focus on what am I going to go big on? In other words, he says, where are you going to prioritize in your life? Where are you going to dedicate yourself? Where are you going to focus? Where are you going to devote your very precious and limited time, energy, and money? Not focus on what I'm going to give up, but what am I going to put in its place? See, that's the problem a lot of times if we tear things down, but don't build them back up again, don't put them back in their place. Good training requires tearing down before it can be built back up. Breaking bad habits is essential Before we can form new ones, I oftentimes with my piano students, I'll receive these students from other teachers, and maybe they've been playing for several years, and they'll have a concern or a problem or an issue with a certain element in a song. And so I'll ask them to play it and show me. And when they show me, I can notice that sometimes there's a bad habit that's gotten into their playing that's preventing them from being able to do their best. And so one of the first things I tell them is they need to break that habit. But I don't just stop there. I don't just say, okay, here's how you break that habit and leave them alone. Instead, I replace that with a correct habit, with a good habit to put in its place, with something to put on the thing that they've given up. Now, the challenge is they do that really well, and they focus on that really well during those 30 minutes of our piano lesson one day a week. But the remainder of the week, if they don't work on it, if all they do is work on the old habit, and they do it the old way, and then when I come, they do it the new way for 30 minutes, guess which one wins? Right. The old way is always going to triumph in that instance. This has to be something that we devote and work and dedicate ourselves to. You cannot build a good life on bad habits, nor can you build a holy life on worldly priorities. We must develop new habits. We must develop disciplines which will allow us to grow and to mature into leaders and followers of Christ, into Hebrews 12:13 leaders, as we begin to grow strong, as we stand up on our weak knees, as we strengthen our tired arms and hands, and we begin to mark out a straight path for our feet. We begin to walk in the strength and vitality of the Lord. We begin to walk in His will, in His peace, in His comfort. We begin to follow Him more and more, and as we do, other people are now seeing our lives. And they're understanding where we're going, and they're watching us, and they're saying, how does he do it? How is he growing? Remember what I said earlier, they watch so that others can watch you grow. But you're growing because of your own desire to follow Christ, and now they're watching you. Those who are weak and lame and are not strong are watching you and saying, how does he do it? I want to be able to do that too. And so they become strong followers of Christ because you point them to Christ, and now they do what you do. And then someone sees them and they say, look at how they're growing in their faith. Look at how they stand up against adversity. Look at how they remain strong. And then they begin to lead others, and they begin to lead others. And one after another, after another, after another, people are discipled and transformed into the likeness of Christ. And this is how you change the world. One life, one person, one human being, one soul at a time is a great harvest. And so next week, we're going to conclude our series. I promise, Scout's Honor, we're going to conclude our series looking at what we put in place after we remove and abstain from the things that we put in our body. What do we put back in? Next week, we're going to look at the idea of spiritual disciplines. So just in closing, I asked some kind of hard questions this week. I asked some tough things that are going to take some time and some examination to really process. And I want to give you that week to do this. I want to give you some time to think through these things, but let me just kind of run back through that list real quick and see, where does the Spirit prompt you? Where do you feel convicted in some of these areas? Where do you know? Where is God saying, yeah, this is really some place you want to work? First, I want you to take some time to examine your life, to think about what's feeding your spirit. What are you putting into your body? And to recognize that it may not be as innocent as you might think on the surface. Second, I'd really like you to consider whether or not you've become desensitized. And if that's the case, we really want to pray for you to receive that sensitivity again. What could be hindering your performance? What things that are good in your life may be getting in the way of your goal? And on that subject, what about the good versus the best? Are you settling for some good thing, some lesser thing? Are you becoming complacent in there rather than allowing God's best to rule your life? If that's you, I pray that God would just restore the excitement and the energy for His best. The final question, probably the most difficult of all. To the casual observer of your life, what would they say that you valued most based on where you spend your limited time, energy, and money? Where do your thoughts come back to during the day? As Lilias Trotter wrote, dare to have it out with God. Ask Him to show you whether or not all is focused on Christ and His glory. Turn your soul's vision to Jesus. Look at Him. And in a strange dimness will come over all that is apart from Him. Look full in His wonderful face. I pray that God would bless you this week. I pray that He would make His face to shine upon you and give you peace. May God's glory surround you and His love infuse your spirit, your soul, and your life. God bless you.